Hi, Karen Smith here. So we're now up to Module 2, and we've reached Lesson 6. And today we're going to look more in depth at the Charter of the United Nations. We're going to look at what it is, how it's gained its legal personality, a little bit about what that means to the nations that signed the Charter, what are the main components of the Charter itself, and does the Charter allow for the United Nations as an organization to stay relevant to the times that we live in today. Plus, I'm going to give you some homework. So, why is it so important that we do look at the UN Charter? Well, as someone who's planning to work in conjunction with the United Nations, it certainly is good to know some of these solid basics. They allow you to better understand the internal workings of the organization and help demystify some of the actions of diplomats and national representatives and the organization as a whole. So just as understanding the human skeletal structure helps us understand or better understand our physiology, physical capacities, and our health needs, having a grasp of the UN legal framework allows us to ask better questions and get better answers from ourselves and from others. So yes, you are strengthening your knowledge of the United Nations and developing your expertise through this process. So now back to June 26th in 1945. What was actually being signed? Well, yes, of course, we know that it was the UN Charter, but what do we mean by a United Nations Charter? The UN Charter is a constituent treaty. Now, what does that mean? Now, if we go back to the meaning of a charter, we can understand a charter as the transfer of certain powers from the grantor, and in this case, the sovereign states or the nations, to the recipient, which in this case was the intergovernmental organization that we know now as the United Nations. And that IGO, the United Nations, then has the prerogative to exercise the rights that were specified in that charter. Now, the UN Charter as a constituent treaty, in fact, gives legal personality and existence to the intergovernmental organization called the United Nations. In other words, this entity did not exist prior to these people gathering together and with the weight of their government's support behind them, giving it specific authority and rights. Now, the UN Charter was the foundational treaty that was signed in San Francisco, War Memorial and Performing Arts Center, on June 26th by 50 of the 51 original member countries, and Poland, as we mentioned before, signed it just a few weeks later. They didn't have a fully authorized representative at the conference. And the treaty was actually entered into force on October 24th in 1945, and that's a few months later, after it had gone through a process of being ratified by the 5 permanent members of the Security Council. That was then, at that time, the Republic of China, and that was later replaced by the People's Republic of China. France, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, which was later replaced by the Russian Federation, the United Kingdom, and the United States, and a majority of the other signatories. So now we're going to take a little bit of a look at the United Nations Charter itself, its structure, and what are its main components. Well, first of all, there's the preamble. I'll just run through these very quickly. First of all, the preamble. Then there are the principles, the purposes and the principles. It outlines the membership. Chapter 3 looks at the organs of the United Nations. Chapter 4, it goes over the General Assembly and how it works. Chapter 5, the Security Council and its scope of work. 6, it looks at the Pacific settlement of disputes. Chapter 7 looks at action with respect to threats to the peace, breaches of the peace, and acts of aggression. And this is often a very quoted section. It's not just dealing with the structure of the United Nations, but how and when it is to work and act. Section or Chapter 8 looks at the regional arrangements. 9, the international economic and social cooperation that underpins the expectations and the outline, the framework for the Economic and Social Council. And Chapter 10 goes into the details of, of how the ECOSOC is established and set up. Chapter 11 looks at the declaration regarding non-self-governing territories, and then 12 was the international trusteeship system, and that's in Chapter 13. Then Chapter 14, it looks at the International Court of Justice and outlines that and how it relates to the rest of the United Nations. Chapter 15 outlines the Secretariat. Then 16 has some miscellaneous provisions. 17, the transitional security arrangements, as things were shifting and changing from to the implementation of the Charter itself, and amendments. And there have since been also further amendments to the United Nations. And Chapter 19 was the statements and part of the Charter that dealt with the ratification and the signatures of the United Nations Charter itself. And its final closing was, in faith whereof the representatives of the governments of the United Nations have signed the present Charter, done at the city of San Francisco, the 26th day of June 1945. And here again, you can just see one of the pages of the UN Charter as it was signed. Now, you can find the Charter online. It's very simple. Just go to this website and you can go into each of the segments, and we'll do that right now. So here we are at the website of the United Nations in the section on the Charter of the United Nations. And so here they have their introductory note. Then it's the preamble and the chapters that we just went through before, all the way down to Chapter 19. So let's take a look just very quickly at the preamble, and I'm certain that you will recognize some of this. We, the peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind, and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women, and of nations large and small, and to establish conditions under which justice and respect for the obligations arising from treaties and other sources of international law can be maintained, and to promote social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom, and for these ends, to practice tolerance and live together in peace with one another as good neighbors, and to unite our strength to maintain international peace and security, and to ensure by the acceptance of principles and the institution of methods that armed force shall not be used save in the common interest, and to employ international machinery for the promotion of the economic and social advancement of all peoples, have resolved to combine our efforts to accomplish these aims. Accordingly, our respective governments, through representatives assembled in the city of San Francisco who have exhibited their full powers found to be in good and due form, have agreed to the present Charter of the United Nations and do hereby establish an international organization to be known as the United Nations. And so then it goes on to define more clearly and specifically through its articles and paragraphs the purposes and principles, its membership, and so on and so forth. Now, as you're working your way through the Charter, I'd like for your homework today to focus on two main questions. So discuss either with a colleague or by making your own notes so that you could get yourself to think this through. First of all, your reading of Chapter 1, Article 2, and Paragraph 7, and Chapter 7, and especially Article 39. Read those, first of all, and then think about that in relation to the Rwandan genocide. How would you have voted if you had been in the Security Council at the time of the plea for help from Rwandans? Do so not just from the point of view of what you feel about the Rwandans, but the moral atrocity that was. But look at the structure of the Charter as it is written and consider the moral dilemma of those charged with upholding international law as it was written at that time and somehow connecting that with the depravity of what was going on and the decisions that needed or were made at the time in terms of the UN forces, the peacekeeping forces. This is a very concrete example of why so many are seriously pondering, is the United Nations, as it is structured today, adequate and capable of establishing a peaceful world the way it is currently structured? It's a fascinating topic, and it really does deserve to be talked out and understood better. Otherwise, it is just very simply mysterious as to why things were done that way. But looking at what happened, if the UN had acted differently, what would have been the implications of those actions? Then also, I'd like you to read Chapter 7, and in particular, Article 39, and this does also feed back into question number 1. And how well can the Security Council deal with terrorism and similar transnational crimes that today threaten the peace? So that's today's homework. So I want you to put yourself into the shoes of those people in the Security Council, and then also to step back and say, well, is the UN structure adequate for today's reality or not? And begin to think about what can, should, maybe could be done at a practical level to make it so. We're going to wrap up very quickly. I just wanted just to add a couple more things very quickly at the end of this, and we're going to go over the emblem. This was approved in 1946, and you can see here that the design is a map of the world representing its azimuthal equidistant projection centered on the North Pole. Of course, as an Australian, I really don't know why they didn't center it on the South Pole, but anyway, inscribed in a wreath consisting of crossed, conventionalized branches of the olive tree. And it was in gold, although we rarely see it in gold these days, but originally it was in gold on a field of smoke blue with all water areas in white. The projection of the map extends to 60 degrees south latitude and includes 5 concentric circles. And that symbolism, of course, the olive branch symbolized peace. The world map depicts the area of concern to the United Nations in achieving its main purpose and security. And there are specific guidelines for the use of that, and they're enunciated in those written in the Resolution 92. And similarly with the flag, it has a description, and it was established as the official emblem of the United Nations in white on a light blue background in 1947. It has specific proportions, and its use is regulated similarly. So I just wanted to revisit Dag Hammarskjöld's quote, "Ours is a work of reconciliation and realistic construction, and this work must be based on respect for the laws by which human civilization has been built. It likewise requires a strict observance of the rules and principles laid down in the charter of this organization, and his work shall be guided by this knowledge." So that takes on a slightly new meaning. That same quote takes on a slightly new meaning after we've had even just a little bit of a look at the charter and what that charter means, what it is as a treaty, what it means in terms of how it is actually laid out with its principles and purposes and the articles of the UN Charter and so forth. With that, I just invite you to get your homework done, to take a little bit more time, take at least the few minutes to go back onto the web and to read some of those relevant sections of the United Nations Charter, to do your homework, strive to understand what they're saying, the implications for them, the ramifications if they are not upheld, get a sense of the dilemmas and the challenges, the frustrations and the inspiration that really does underpin and thread itself through this work of the United Nations. So we looked at quite a bit today. We looked at the Charter, what it is, how it's gained its legal personality, what it is, a little bit about what it means to the nations that signed the Charter and the challenges, the dilemmas that, and the opportunities that it has provided, and what are the main components of the Charter, and how does this Charter allow the organization to stay relevant in the globalizing 21st century. There is one part in there that I encourage you to find that really does hold something of a key for enabling the Charter to really be renewed. So do complete your 30 minutes commitment to your work for building and expanding your expertise and knowledge of the United Nations, and I look forward to seeing you tomorrow for our next lesson. Much success to you in all that you do.